everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for another episode of It's All About Food. I'm back in New York. I have been away in California for most of the summer, musical directing Into the Woods. It's over. My partner Gary and I have been home for a week, and we're recovering. I'm realizing now I was really pushing hard, working 13 to 14 hour days. There was a lot of stress, a lot of intensity, and just transitioning back home has been interesting. We've come back to very different weather, where it's very humid here, hot and humid. We don't like to use air conditioning, so adjusting to that has been fun. And I think I'm just about feeling back to normal. So I'm happy to be able to do this show today. I have a lot more opportunity now to read, like read the newspaper and catch up on things. And last week, someone sent me an article to read and wondered what I thought about it. And I'm basing my show on it for a lot of reasons. I didn't agree with the article, and I want to talk about why I don't. And I also want to show how to analyze an article and show how it can be very misleading, while sounding very intelligent and forthright. Okay, are you ready? The article I'm going to discuss is The Organic Industry is Lying to You by Henry I. Miller, which was in the Wall Street Journal, published on August 5th. And I wanted to cover a number of topics that he brought up. The first thing that he brought up is that the FDA is problematic because they don't do the work and they don't do the work fairly. So he says that the FDA gives a complete pass to blatantly false and deceptive advertising claims, like when Whole Foods, for example, says that organic foods are grown without toxic or persistent pesticides. A lot of us say this. And it isn't exactly true. I will agree with him because, as he mentioned in his article, organic farmers do rely on synthetic and natural pesticides. And he says, just as conventional farmers do. And this is where I disagree with him. And he cites an article, an old one, in fact, from 1990, where the quote was, 99.99% of the pesticides in American diet are chemicals that plants produce to defend themselves. I find that quote particularly misleading, and I'll get into that in a moment. He also talks about how some companies get away with misleading labeling, like Tropicana can't say that their product is fat-free, and the FDA won't let them because it's not a product that contains fat. But they get away with saying that their orange juice is non-GMO project verified. And he's complaining that the FDA is not doing their job when it comes to labeling products that say they're non-GMO project verified or non-GMO labeling in general. And he says it's deceptive. I'll get back to the article and some other issues it brought up. But first, I want to talk about the FDA. I agree that the FDA doesn't do its job, and there's lots of reasons why it doesn't. I want to cite an article that was in Politico a couple of years ago, and it was entitled, Former Commissioners Make FDA an Independent Agency. Six former Food and Drug Administration commissioners from Democratic and GOP administrations dating back to the Reagan era called on Congress to make the agency independent. That's what the article says. And these officials served in the Reagan, Clinton, and Obama, and both Bush administrations. And they endorsed an idea at the Spotlight Health, part of the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado. They represent more than three decades of FDA experience. Reading a quote from the article, the FDA is trapped in a structural problem, said Andrew von Eschenbach, commissioner during the Bush administration from 2006 and 2009 and acting commissioner from 2005 into 2006. The former commissioners noted that the agency is funded as though it's part of the Department of Agriculture, but it operates under Health and Human Services. That creates bureaucratic barriers and limits its ability to respond to public health emergencies, they said. I like following Marion Nessel, who is a professor at NYU and an author, and she has the website foodpolitics.com. I've interviewed her a number of times on this program. She responded to that article in her blog on foodpolitics.com back in July of 2016, and she agreed that the structure is a problem, but she said it wasn't only the structural problem that impedes the work of this agency. The other problem is how it gets funded. The FDA is a public health agency housed in the health department, but it gets congressional funding from the House and Senate agricultural committees. And she writes, this can hardly be expected to be sympathetic to the FDA's regulatory mission to help keep foods safe and labeled accurately. She goes on saying that we badly need food policy linked to health policy, better linkage of the FDA's and the USDA's food safety regulation, and better coordination of food and nutrition policy overall. Now, this conversation was started in 2016, and I'm not sure it's gone very far since then. We have a new administration that doesn't seem to be concerned particularly about people and people's health. So we'll see where that goes. So yes, I agree that the FDA is not doing the job it's supposed to be doing. There are many regulations that seem to be ignored that should not be, that could have benefit. But I don't agree with the author, Henry Miller, in his article, "The Organic Industry is Lying to You," about some of the things that the FDA do when it comes to allowing the label non-GMO project verified or non-GMO in general labeling, because I would like GMO labeling. And the administration has dragged a long time saying that it's not going to label or require labeling of GMO foods, and people want to know. Now, Henry Miller is of the opinion that GMO foods are safe and healthy and fine. And we can go into that conversation, and maybe I will just briefly. I don't necessarily like to talk about whether or not genetically modified foods are safe or not. It's a heated debate. We haven't had adequate studies to determine whether they cause health problems or not. It would be very expensive and very difficult to do, and they haven't been done. I prefer to talk about how GMO foods are grown. They support a number of things that we know are bad for people and bad for the environment and bad for animals too. So, GMO food production promotes monocropping, and monocropping means growing one plant over a large swath of land. It's easier for the farmers to grow one thing and treat it the same way and harvest it the same way, but it's not good for the soil, it's not good for the environment, it's not good for biodiversity. Variety is the spice of life. We don't want one kind of potato. We want many thousands of kinds of potatoes. Biodiversity is good for the planet, and monocropping is something that works against supporting biodiversity. Another thing about the production of GMO foods, although when they were originally introduced, and sometimes they may still use this argument, they say that GMO foods will require less herbicides and pesticides in order for them to grow. And we now know that that is a tremendously false statement. We can talk about Roundup, and I will later in the program, and what's going on with that. But we've seen that superweeds are a result of plants. Weeds, considered weeds, are becoming stronger against the herbicides that are used against them. And so greater amounts of these herbicides are put in the soil, making the soil even more toxic. Another thing that I don't like that GMO foods support or encourage is that most of the GMO foods grown today, like soybeans, are fed to animals to feed people. And as a vegan and someone who promotes a whole foods plant-based diet, I do not believe that growing animals for food is healthy or good for people, especially in the factory farm confined animal feedlot operation formats that are used today to grow more animals. And they're frequently fed genetically modified soybeans, corn, and alfalfa. And because we don't have a requirement to label foods that are genetically modified, I personally appreciate foods that are labeled non-GMO. Now, the one easy way to do that is to buy foods that are certified organic. But that's not always possible. And sometimes I might buy a packaged food. I don't encourage buying things in a box. I like to quote Jack Lane, who said, if man made it, don't eat it. But if a product that I'm interested in has a label that says non-GMO or non-GMO project certified on it, or non-GMO project verified, excuse me, I have a little more comfort in buying that product. I will still turn it around and look at the list of ingredients because I don't trust anybody. But I prefer labels like that. I like labels that say vegan. I like labels that say gluten-free. And there are products today that say that they're gluten-free that have never had any gluten in them. And some may say that this is ridiculous. And under the absence claim, shouldn't be allowed to put that. But for people that are concerned about gluten, especially parents with young children who have celiac disease, for example, that's a product that will stand out to them. And still, if they're cautious, they'll turn it around and look at the ingredients and make sure that the product wasn't made in a facility that had gluten or other wheat products produced. But still, these labels of absence claim help. And I don't have a problem with them at all. And just for a moment, I want to talk about fat-free. I've talked about this before because the author of this article brings up that orange juice can't be labeled as fat-free because it doesn't have fat in it. But there are products that are allowed to be labeled fat-free. And as I mentioned, I think it was on a recent program, the FDA allows certain products that have a serving size of less than half a gram of fat. So if you're eating 2 servings, you get a gram of fat. If you're eating 4 servings, you're getting 2 grams of fat, and it goes like that. But it's still, the product is still allowed to be labeled fat-free because it meets this particular regulation. And I find that a little deceptive because many of the serving sizes are designed to be small enough so that they can be labeled fat-free, and it's a size that most people wouldn't consider a serving. They would want to eat more of the item. And this is another case where the FDA regulations and labeling are deceptive. And I think the FDA needs to change. As I mentioned earlier, they need to become an independent agency where they can really focus on human health. Okay, now let's move on to the issue of toxic chemicals used in organic farming. And I'm going to be citing a report that came out in February of 2017 by Ken Roseborough on the non-GMOreport.com website. And it's called Debunking, quote, Alternative Facts, end quote, about pesticides used in organic farming. And Ken writes, with the growing demand for organic foods in the U.S., there has been a backlash from agribusiness groups, companies, and individuals who see organic as a threat to their interests. The critics accuse the organic industry of using deceptive marketing practices to get consumers to pay more money for organic food. Another line of attack has been that organic farmers use lots of pesticides, some of which are more toxic than those used by conventional farmers. And the article goes into detail talking that, number one, there are 25 synthetic products that are actually allowed or approved to be used in organic production, but 900 synthetic pesticides approved to be used in conventional farming. And there are also many natural-based substances that are used in organic farming, like neem oil, pepper, things like that, that are pretty harmless. The point of the article is that the materials that are used in organic farming are not as dangerous as what is being used in conventional farming. And the author of the article I brought up today, Dr. Miller, was talking specifically about copper, how copper is used in organic farming. And it's true. Copper can have adverse effects on soil microorganisms, adverse effects on human, aquatic, and terrestrial life during farm-level application or from residuals in food. But the interesting thing is that conventional farmers use copper too. Copper is exempt from an EPA tolerance, and it's an essential nutrient. Now, for organic certification standards, the soil needs to be tested to see if it has excessive amounts of copper sulfate accumulating. And that's not the same for conventional farming. And conventional farmers tend to use a lot more of these dangerous ingredients. And then there's the concern that BT insecticide is used for organic agriculture, and it's also used in conventional agriculture, but in a genetically engineered form where the crops actually have the BT inside the plant, and it's not the same. When organic farmers use a foliar BT spray to kill insects, there's the GM corn that has the BT toxins inside the kernel itself, and they remain there when the corn is cooked and eaten. And people will get a high dose of the BT toxin when they eat the genetically modified corn. And that's not true with the organic food that is simply sprayed with the foliar BT spray, because that spray, the BT in the spray, breaks down quickly and it doesn't remain on the plant. So we're talking about two different things. And you may know some organic farmers that don't even consider using synthetic substances from the approved national list. That's not how they operate. And that's why I encourage getting to know your farmers and supporting small farms, not buying from the big agribusinesses, even the organic ones. It's better to support the local organic farmers, even the farmers that don't have the organic certification. You may get to know them better and find that they don't use anything at all. And this is important. It's important to know who you're buying your food from. That's what I love about CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, because this is really an opportunity to support a local farmer and get to know them, because many of these CSAs have events and activities where you can go to the farm and get to know the people that are growing your food. Now, the author of this article that I'm talking about from the Wall Street Journal called "The Organic Industry is Lying to You" is a physician and molecular biologist and a fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. And it says he was founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. Reading this article, which was basically telling us that we should be concerned about the organic food industry, with the implication that conventional / industrial foods grown with those 900 synthetic pesticides and herbicides are equivalent or just as good, I thought about the Stanford study back in 2012. Do you remember it? The one that was called "Are Organic Foods Safer or Healthier than Conventional Alternatives? A Systematic Review." It got a lot of press. It was a disappointing and frustrating study. Many articles have been written about it, and I'll talk about one in particular. But what they came up saying after a meta review of many other studies is that organic foods aren't any more nutritious than conventional industrial grown foods. We were all very alarmed and disappointed when this study came out and couldn't wait for people to start analyzing it and telling us that there were a lot of things wrong with it because we wanted to believe our organic food was more nutritious. Mark Bittman, food writer at the New York Times at the time, did write an article called "That Flawed Stanford Study." But he made a very important point, and he said, "The Stanford study was not only an exercise in misdirection, it was a headline generator. By providing, quote, useful and, quote, counterintuitive information about organic food, it played right into the hands of the news-hungry while conveniently obscuring important features of organic agriculture." What was one of those features? This meta-study analysis of more than 200 existing studies does say that consumption of organic foods may reduce exposure to pesticide residues and antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Mark Bittman continues in the article saying, "Since that's largely why people eat organic foods, what's the big deal?" So with Dr. Miller telling us in his recent Wall Street Journal article that the organic industry is lying to us, I don't think it's a fair title. Again, it's another one of these headline makers, right? But it's very misleading. And organic foods, even in this terrible study that Stanford did 6 years ago, it couldn't avoid realizing that organic foods expose us to less pesticide residues and antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Now, there was another study done a year before in April 2011 by scientists at Newcastle University in England, and it barely got a mention in the media. They also did one of these meta-analysis studies, and they found that organic fruits and vegetables grown in the usual way were indeed more nutritious, had more vitamin C on average, and many more of the plant defense molecules that in people helped shield against cancer and heart disease. So it shows that you can do a meta-analysis and get very different results. But without any studies, we know that healthy food needs to grow in healthy soil. And healthy soil needs to be alive. It needs to be alive with microorganisms. It needs to be alive with worms. It needs to be alive with species that nurture and feed the soil. We know that herbicides and pesticides kill. Pesticides kill animals. Herbicides kill plants. And they destroy the living, healthy environment in the soil. And as a result, we need to add petrochemical fertilizers to conventional industrial grown foods so that they can grow. And let's link that to climate change, because as we dig petroleum out of the earth and use it as fertilizer, that releases carbon dioxide that gets into the environment and warms the earth. Now, some will say the plants consume that carbon dioxide and create oxygen, but we are very out of balance at this point in terms of plant life consuming CO2 in order to balance the environment and not cause additional warming. My point is that growing foods with pesticides and herbicides deadens the soil. Organic farming does not. The soil needs to be alive in organic farming. And when we grow foods in live, enriched soil, enriched with natural materials, the plant foods are naturally going to be healthier, more nutritious. And I believe the organic community is always looking to improve. For example, there's a widely spread myth about organic approved pesticides that organic farmers use, like Rodinon. And this is a broad spectrum insecticide, and it's known to be toxic. And it has been banned by the EPA for use in the United States. But there are some countries who grow organic food like organic bananas, and they may still use this product. and this needs to change. And it's another reason to look for organically grown, locally grown food. This way you get the best and the benefits of both organic foods and locally grown foods. Even better, grow your own. So bottom line is, we need to be voting for people that support our ideas. We need to be educating our representatives in government. And through this process, I am hopeful that we can make positive change, especially working towards getting the FDA to become an independent agency that is not allowed to be influenced by corporate lobbyists and people that have a specific agenda in order to promote their own products, which may not be in the best interest of public health. I'm continuing to read and enjoy reading, and one article I just read yesterday was entitled, "In Thailand, Obesity in Our Monks is a Ticking Time Bomb." It's in the New York Times. I don't know what your image or stereotype of a monk is. And of course, those who are Buddhists, we have those lovely little happy Buddha sculptures, the little small ones, the big ones. I've seen some really gigantic ones. And usually the Buddha is shown with a big happy belly. Not necessarily the most slim person, but apparently monks are gaining a lot of weight. And what they do is they go around in the mornings and they get donated food from people. And people are tending to give them foods that may not be the most nutritious. But even more so, what they say is they're not supposed to eat later in the day. And so what they do to keep their energy up is they drink. And they've been given a lot of sugary drinks. So they're drinking these high sugar drinks and getting obese. And this is a sad, sad reflection on today's society. Stay away from those sugary drinks. There are 4 grams of sugar in a teaspoon of refined sugar. 4 grams. There are 39 grams in a 12-ounce container of Coke. That's more than 9 teaspoons of sugar in a 12-ounce glass. And I know people like to drink a lot, especially in the summer. Check the labels. See how many grams of sugar are in the drinks you are drinking. It could be tea. It could be many things. But I recommend not consuming any refined sugar at all or any of the sweeteners like honey and agave, brown rice syrup, corn syrup, maple syrup. All of these are just like sugar for the most part. And these are treats. These are foods that if we want to consume them, they should not be consumed on a regular basis. I like to sweeten things from time to time with dates, especially because dates are a whole food. And they too, we shouldn't eat too many of them. But for a treat, they're especially good because they actually come, if you use dates and date paste made from dates, they have fiber and lots of nutrients in them. So that's just a little summer tip, because I know in the hot weather that many of us are experiencing, we should be drinking. I can't drink enough. I find I'm eating less and drinking a lot more. But drinking sugary beverages is not what we want to do. Not at all. So while we're on the subject of hydrating, what are you drinking? This is the time where I like to bring out the drinks that I really enjoy in the summer. I'm a big tea drinker, and I haven't been drinking a lot of caffeine lately. One of the reasons is my partner Gary has given up caffeine for the most part. He discovered it really affects his sleeping, and caffeine does affect people differently. And what I did was I just cleared out all of the teas that we've had in the house, and I haven't gotten to reordering anybody. We just came back from a long trip in California. I just haven't gotten to it. But what am I drinking? I love hydrating with cool drinks when we're in very humid weather. Obviously, one of the things you can do is always squeeze fresh lemon or lime. And we've been eating some pineapple, and I like to put the core of the pineapple, the part that's difficult to eat, I put that in my water, and that gives it a nice pineapple-y fresh flavor. I got that idea when we were in Costa Rica in April. The resort we were at had one of these big coolers of water, and they would always put fresh fruit in it. One day it had oranges in it, and one day it had pineapple in it. And it wasn't like you were drinking a pineapple juice. It was just the water, lightly and naturally flavored with little bits of fruit. I love it. And somehow, and maybe there's some science behind this or not, I have no idea, but I feel when my water is flavored with fruits like these, I feel the water is wetter. Is that nutty? But I feel like it really satisfies me better. It quenches my thirst better than if I'm drinking just plain unflavored water. It's just a thing. I don't know if it's true or not. I put it out there. So in the summertime, rather than boiling water and making hot tea, although some will say that hot tea can actually be cooling because it causes you to sweat and sweat will cool you down. Sometimes I'm just not in the mood to drink hot liquids. If you take the tea, and this can be an herbal tea, it can be a black tea, a green tea, a white tea, and put it in a container of water. I like to put about 4 cups of water in a large wide mouth jar with my tea, and I just put it in the refrigerator. In about 2 hours, it has cold brewed to perfection. I love doing this. And I've made my black teas, my green teas, my white teas, and now I'm making more herbal teas where I'll put in hibiscus, maybe some lemon, some peppermint. I make my own brews, my own blends. Makes it fun. You can add herbs like basil, because basil is like a mint. And depending on what you like, there are many herbs and seeds too. I like to add a little fennel or anise to some of these brews. It gives it a little licorice-y flavor. There's just so many options and it's fun. Have you come up with any blends that you like? I want to hear about it. Of course, another fun thing to do when you're thinking about making drinks, party drinks, things that are great for the summer, is to blend a melon. Have you ever done that? Sometimes when the melons are really ripe and a really good price, this is a good time to do this, where you just put the melon in a blender and you can pour it. You can dilute it if you want or not. Sometimes I like to freeze them and make cubes out of them. I'll put them in ice trays and I can add those to water or other drinks. They're colorful. They're fun. You could also re-blend with a high-powered Vitamix the frozen chunks of melons and make like a sorbet. These are all healthy and wholesome and colorful and sweet without any added sugar. No 4 grams per teaspoon of refined sugar here, just the good healthy sugar. And the sugar that comes in fruit, remember, is not the same as refined sugar or sugar in fruit juice. When the sugar is delivered in a whole fruit with the fiber, the body knows how to digest it. The body knows what to do with it and take the benefits from it. It does not know what to do with sugar when the sugar has been processed, isolated from the fiber and the whole fruit. Not the same. This week, while we've been transitioning back to being at home, we've been tired. We haven't been in the mood to cook. It's been hot and humid. And the food we've been making has been pretty simple. I kind of opt for smoothies a lot of the time. And eating out. I've eaten out a bit this week. I wanted to talk about one day of good eating out. I went to one of my favorite restaurants, Candle Cafe West, for lunch. I was meeting someone I knew from college, and I hadn't seen her in, I think, 38 years, some crazy thing like that. But on Facebook now, you can find people and get to know people or get reacquainted with people, and we decided to meet for lunch. And I love going to Candle Cafe West, and I was very fortunate because the owners, Bart and Joy, were there. I've had them on the show numerous times. I've talked about them many times because they're just wonderful people filled with so much love. So I spoiled myself and got a hug from both of them. And I had a wonderful salad, arugula with wild mushrooms. And very often I like to order dishes with mushrooms when I'm eating out away from Gary because Gary doesn't like to eat mushrooms. This is a delicious combination, arugula with mushrooms, and it's so good for you. The friend that I was with, we had a delightful time, but she surprised me. Now I got to give her a lot of credit. She's not a vegan, and she was very open to my recommendation of meeting at this restaurant. She lives in New Jersey, so she's not in Manhattan all the time. And she got a nice salad. She was asking me what to order because things weren't familiar to her. And my basic suggestion was just eat foods that you know. Fruits and vegetables. Eat a salad. They make beautiful salads here. And indeed, they do. There was no reason to introduce her to seitan or tempeh or a tofu if it wasn't something she was familiar with. I wanted her to have a delicious, good experience. And I think, personally, the best vegan foods are the ones that are the whole minimally processed foods, the fruits and vegetables. So we had a nice lunch. But what surprised me was, I'm always thinking that since I'm surrounded by so many activists and people in the vegan movement, that the movement is saturated with experts and activists that are reaching out and creating new products and opening restaurants and being coaches and telling people how to eat more plant foods. There are so many of them, I'm overwhelmed sometimes. I think, oh yeah, I don't need to do this anymore. There are many other people out there doing it, doing a great job. And then I sit with a friend who is not familiar with quinoa and doesn't even know how to pronounce it. Now, that's not unusual because quinoa is spelled Q-U-I-N-O-A, and in the English language, we want to pronounce it quinoa or something like that, or quinoa. And I remember the first time I discovered it, I didn't know how to pronounce it, but that was like 20 years ago. I don't know. It was a long time ago. I thought that quinoa was a pretty hip food today. And then I realized that there are still many, many people, many intelligent, educated people who may not be particularly passionate about food like I am, that are not aware of all of the new food products that we have access to, or maybe the benefits of a healthy plant-based diet. It's surprising to me, and I always have to check myself and realize that we're all on different journeys, different life experiences, and many of us come from different cultures and societies. We don't all come with the same foundation of knowledge when we cross paths, and we can't assume things. So I guess that means I'm just going to keep on blabbling about food as often as I can to as many people as I can, because I think it's important. When I first stepped into the restaurant at Candle Cafe West and I saw the owners, Joy and Bart, they pointed out there was one family there where the father had been vegan for 42 years. And here I am, only vegan for 30 years. I just checked and I went vegan in June of 1988. 30 years ago. Hard to believe. And there are some lovely people out there who've been doing it longer than me, like my friend Linda Long. She's also vegan for 42 years. Something about 42. I wonder what happened 42 years ago that impacted people to become vegan. So if you're not vegan and you're vegan curious, or you're not familiar with all of these healthy foods that we have access to today, you've come to the right place. And I invite you to visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can read my blog. There's now over 1,260 posts of what vegans eat, specifically myself and my partner, Gary. And sometimes it's very focused on healthy, nutritious food. Sometimes we're a little challenged, like people are, and you can see what we choose to eat during challenging times. I wanted to bring up another food that a lot of people don't know much about, and that's jackfruit. Have you heard about jackfruit? Have you tried it? It's a fruit. It grows in tropical environments. And it's becoming quite popular in the vegan scene because it has a meaty texture to it. And I've tried a number of different products. There's canned jackfruit that you can marinate and season any way you like. It's a little like chopped meat, ground beef in texture, and so it's often used as a taco filling or in like a floppy joes or something where you can season it a lot and still have that chewy texture. But what's wonderful about it is it's a whole food with a great texture. I'm bringing it up because on the same day that I went to Candle Cafe West, I met Gary Lader, who's in rehearsals for a new play called Sign of the Times in the New York Summer Theater Festival next week, and he was really hungry. We went to Beyond Sushi, and I ordered one of their new summer salads, and it had jackfruit in it. And it was very different than the jackfruit I had ever eaten before because this wasn't shredded. This was big chunks of jackfruit that they had seasoned in a certain way and put on top of a bed of other different vegetables and salad makings. It was really delicious. But this jackfruit had a texture like a swordfish or something like that. Now, I haven't eaten fish in 30 years, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But these chunks were very steak-like. Not beef steak-like, but fish steak-like. And I think that could be an excellent food product for many people who are looking for that texture but don't want to consume animal products. And this is a natural food. This isn't something that requires tons of investment capital to create a business that's creating a plant food that's highly processed, that is like animal foods. This is a natural food that's been used this way for a long time, but some of us are just getting introduced to it. And I can't wait to play with it a little more. I'm more excited about the chunkier variety than the flaked, piecier variety. It's summertime, and there's a lot of zucchini going around, isn't there? And for people who have gardens, this is a time when zucchini seems to be growing faster and larger. And the question is, what to do with it? What do you do with zucchini? I remember friends in college when they had too many zucchinis. We were all making zucchini bread. And there's only so much zucchini bread one can consume. Do you have a favorite zucchini recipe? I'd love to hear about it. One of the zucchini foods that's kind of trending these days are what are called zoodles. When I first made zucchini noodles, I didn't know they were called zoodles, but now they're zoodles. And this is where you make a spaghetti-like or angel hair pasta-like spaghetti noodle from zucchini. And there are these tools that you can purchase, and they're relatively inexpensive. There are different kinds. One is called a salatico, there's a spiralizer, and there are some maybe without names that I'm not familiar with. But it's kind of a popular food item now because for people that want to get away from pasta because refined flour isn't really a healthy food, a zucchini noodle is a nice substitute. I never was fond of eating them raw, however. It's just a personal thing. Some people like it, especially with a Parmesan. And I make a Parmesan that's vegan, of course, with a nut or seed and the garlic and the basil all blended up. That's anything with that is delicious. But zucchini noodles can be blanched or lightly cooked, and I find I like them better that way. But there are so many things that you can do with zucchini. For example, you can make chips, and everybody loves chips, right? You can slice the zucchini thinly and then bake it at a low temperature or dehydrate them. Dehydrating will take a lot longer. Baking will take quicker. But very often people just want something to munch on, right? And a zucchini chip, especially if you season it nicely with some herbs and spices, can be a really fun snack to have. They can also be pickled. Have you ever pickled your zucchini? I'm just kind of getting into the fermenting vegetable scene, but zucchinis can be good for pickling. There are some old-fashioned things that zucchini is good for. Of course, there's the famous French dish ratatouille, which is made with zucchini and eggplant and tomatoes and bell peppers, all cooked up in a pot and with a little herbe de Provence. Some people add olive oil. I tend to avoid adding oil to my food. But ratatouille is great, served hot or cold. It's a great summer dish. Zucchini can be blended in just about anything. You could blend it into your smoothie and you'll never know it's there. I've enjoyed grating zucchini with onions and making patties out of them, like zucchini patties. And you could add other things to them if you want it to be a little heartier, more substantial, like a cornmeal, and make a cornmeal zucchini pancake, for example. But you can grate and freeze zucchini and use it later to make more zucchini bread at another season. There's so many things you can do with zucchini, and it's a great food because it's a vegetable with fiber and it's not too starchy. So you can eat as many zucchinis as you can hold in your belly. What I like really doing with zucchini is making stuffed zucchini. Now, the round zucchini are the best for this, but you can use any zucchini, especially if your zucchini are getting really large. And all you do is, if you're using the round zucchini, you cut off the top and scoop out the inside, and you can use that inside sautéed with other vegetables and seasonings and then put it back into the zucchini and bake it. Or you can use the horizontal ones, the long ones, and depending on their size, you can cut them in half and scoop out the interior and then restuff them. Or if it's not large enough, you might want to just skim off the top and scoop it out and fill it up horizontally. But they're really fun and beautiful, really beautiful. And while I'm always learning these new food terms, we have the zucchini noodles, which are zoodles. Have you had zucchini oats, which are called zoats? I have to confess, I haven't tried zucchini oats, but it looks simple enough where you grate the zucchini and add it to the oats and you can cook them together and flavor it as you like. Another thing you can do with zucchini is make zucchini fries. And there are lots of different ways to do this. And actually, I'm giving you a sneak preview because I'm working on a new zucchini fry recipe. I can't tell you about it just yet because it needs to be published. But you can look at a picture of them on my What Vegans Eat blog. So zucchini fries are often breaded with some sort of breading, and sometimes they're topped with Parmesan cheese. And there are many wonderful vegan versions of Parmesan cheese out today. Some of them are extra stinky, some of them are mildly stinky, and you may not like the stinkiness of them. But then there are the nutritional yeast varieties that you can make at home, where you grind a little nutritional yeast with your favorite nut or seed and salt and have something nice to sprinkle on things that has a cheesy-like taste to it. I like that a lot. But zucchini fries, the problem with them, if there's a problem, is that they are fried, obviously, and frying isn't really a healthy way to prepare food. And the other thing is the breadings are often made with refined flours. In the recipe that I'm working on, my zucchini fries are baked. Can we call them fries when they're baked? I guess so. We can call a lot of things whatever we want. We're calling plant milks milk, even though the dairy milk people don't want us calling it milk. And we call our vegan butters butter, even though it's not made from cow milk. And we call a lot of plant meats, meats. And this is what happens in language. The definition of words morph into new things. And so my zucchini fries aren't fried, they're baked. And I don't use white flour either. I don't use any flour, actually. Stay tuned and you'll find out what's in them, but they're amazingly good. Another fun thing to do with zucchini is making a different kind of noodle from them, more like a lasagna noodle, where you use a mandolin and thinly slice them lengthwise, so you have these long noodles, and you can use them as a lasagna noodle, or you can roll them up. This is fun, where you make a filling, and it can be made from vegetables or like a vegan ricotta that's lightly seasoned. You can fill the zucchini with that and roll them up and then put them in a nice type of tomato sauce. I like to use our almond ricotta recipe. Have you tried it yet? It is the most amazing thing on the planet, and I have to bring it up again. Not only would it be good in a zucchini roll-up or a zucchini lasagna, it's good in everything. And all it is almonds, or almonds and miso. The miso gives it a saltier, cheesier flavor, but if you soak almonds overnight, now I like to use raw almonds, I've told you this before, and then I use the Zen method of gently removing the skins off of the almonds once they've soaked, then you blend them up, and that's it. You use enough water to get the consistency that you like, and you make this wonderful almond ricotta, adding in a little miso to it, and it's amazing. Another thing we love to do in the summer is make grilled vegetables, and zucchinis are an excellent addition to any skewer. And then you can eat them just grilled or barbecued like that, but they're also great once they're grilled to put in a sandwich. So grilled vegetables in general, grilled zucchini, grilled onions, grilled portobello mushroom, grilled red pepper are great with a pesto like I mentioned before. And you can take your favorite bread and make a grilled vegetable sandwich. I don't do bread very often, but when I do and I make it like this, it is such a treat. It's so great in the summer. Grilled zucchini. Or barbecued zucchini, based on the tools that you have. And I mentioned at the beginning of this discussion about zucchini that you can make zucchini chips. Well, you can also make like cute little zucchini appetizers where you slice the zucchini into rounds and you can top them with anything. Tomatoes, a bean spread, your favorite vegan cheese, and pop them in the oven. And they're lovely little pop-in-the-mouth, bite-sized appetizers. Oh, there are so many things you can do with zucchini. You know, we mentioned zucchini bread earlier, but there's also zucchini muffins and zucchini cookies. You could put zucchini in just about everything. And I didn't even mention soup. Zucchini's great in lots of soups, creamed soups, or have it chunky in different soups. So if you have a lot of zucchini, or maybe you don't have a lot of zucchini, but you're curious about zucchini, which some people call courgette. There's lots of things that you can do with them. And while I'm thinking about wrapping up this program, I'm going to say that you can also put zucchini in a wrap. Why not? Grated or grilled. You can even use the zucchini as a wrap. Like I said before, if you make those long zucchini noodles like lasagna noodles, you can roll them up on a salad plate and put some salad in them, or make a maki out of them without using nori, but use zucchini instead. So many opportunities. But I'm going to wrap up this show now because I've talked about zucchini so much, I'm getting really, really hungry. What I wanted to say is if you ever read an article like the one I mentioned at the beginning of the program, The Organic Industry is Lying to You, if you read it and you're wondering about it, is it true? Is it something you should be concerned about? Maybe something's not sitting right with you. I would love it if you shared it with me, especially if it was about food, and I can tell you my opinion of it and maybe lead you to some resources that would give you more clarity on the subject. So I am going to wrap it up now. You've been listening to It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and I'm the co-founder of Responsible Eating and Living, a nonprofit that provides truth and tools for healthy eating, wellness, and green living. And I hope you visit our site from time to time. We're always putting up new information, recipes, there's the blog, there are the transcriptions to this radio show, and much more. If you have any comments or questions, you know where to find me. I'm at info@realmeals.org. Thank you so much for listening, and everybody, please have a delicious week. Bye-bye. Thank you.